Sometimes, you see, I actually put my sermon together and then look at what Guy has sent to me for the order of service. And I had decided that I was going to read that passage again just before the sermon. And so when I actually saw the order of service, and it was before the sermon, I thought it was still good for us to hear it twice. Mainly because that's really where our thinking is. And one of the things about this particular reading for me is some of the background. Now, I believe that you're doing this as a sort of series, so that I'm sure that you will have dealt with some of the background, but let me just remind you, especially if you weren't in for those sermons. Because Paul is writing to a church at Colossae, which, like all the churches, was relatively new. But the church at Colossae was having all sorts of issues. It was set in a very vibrant town. And one of the things that had begun to develop was this thing called Gnosticism. I'm sorry, I don't get any choice but to use the word, that's what it was called. Fundamentally, meaning Gnosis has something to do with knowledge. And in fact, Gnosticism in the end became that you had the knowledge of Christ and one or two other things, and that gave you salvation. So it was a saving knowledge. It wasn't a saving grace. It wasn't a saving faith. And it had also got mixed up a bit with Judaism too. They got some Judaistic culture in it. So that this was just one of the strong things that was actually sort of banging on the door of the early church there. And of course, there was all the immorality that existed in Colossae and all the other things that went on in a vibrant town. And it was in that background that Paul was writing to them. But his own background was also not terribly helpful at the time, because as you heard from the reading, he was in prison, he was in chains, and he was in prison and being chained for the gospel and for his faith. Now, this particular passage, it's a very short passage. That's one of the reasons I could also ask it to be read twice. It didn't take a minute to read it, but it does seem to me that it's a seriously underrated passage. I've tried to create one sermon out of this under God. I really should have been preparing 10, to be honest, so that you're getting a compressed version as far as I'm concerned. If this had just been part of the lectionary, I think that what I would have done is just picked out the bit that I wanted to do and expanded it more. But I wanted to deal with the whole of it because I know in the context that's probably what needs to be done. But it's an underrated passage because the Bible I use at home is one which is a study Bible. And it gives you all sorts of comments at the bottom and references to other bits of the Bible. And like many of the modern Bibles, it also gives you some headings for the passages. And this one was headed Further Instruction. Now, that's fair enough in one sense, but in another sense, it seemed to me that they'd seriously underrated what was in the passage. Because it's far more than that, and I think that it actually should have been titled More Tools for Evangelism. Because there are five different tools in those short verses that we ought to know and take on board as a church and as evangelists. If you think that evangelist really is just something to do with somebody like Billy Graham, I'm sure all of you at least are old enough to remember him. I know many people who were converted under him. I went to many of his rallies. He was a brilliant preacher. He was always referred to as an evangelist. But one of the things that I did learn in college, and I'm going to tell you in a moment how little Greek I know, one of the things I did Learning College was that we're all evangelists. We're all evangelists, because evangelist really just means telling the good news. Telling the good news, that's for all of us to do. So that this passage should be headed in my book, More Tools for Evangelism. And the first one that Paul sets out is prayer. That has many connotations. But Paul, first of all, actually asks people to pray for him and for the team in the way that they are trying to present the gospel and that people might be able to hear. So one of the things that Paul is actually saying here about prayer is that it's a team effort. And it is. We're a team together. We're a team as the church. And any of you watching the football, and I must confess, it didn't really fill me with a lot of thrills, but I feel obliged to watch England when they play, sadly. I watched sort of the first half yesterday and gave up, really, and was at least pleased to know that somebody did something in the second half. But it's a team effort. And one of the problems for teams like England is that what you're trying to do is trying to pull together all sorts of people from all sorts of different teams in the country and put them together and expect, because they're stars in their own team, that they're going to be stars in one team together. Well, if you get a lot of people together who are full of themselves, they don't usually work together well as a team. But we're supposed to be a team within the church. We're supposed to be concentrating our prayer and our efforts and our attitude on making sure that people hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. And one of the first things that Paul asks for, which is quite right, is you pray for your leaders. Because in some ways, you know, we expect leaders, ministers, elders, whoever they are, they're the people who are the shining examples. They can actually just go on and get on with it because they're sufficient in themselves. I can assure you that we as leaders actually need you all to pray for us and support us, because it's a team effort. When I was a young fella, well, I keep going back, don't I? But when I was a young fella, I'd just come out of ministry, and I'd just come out of college and gone into ministry, and I was, what, 27. And I went into a church in East London, and one of its members was a lady who was a little bit older than me and a little bit older than most of the people here, I suspect, because she was 98 when I went and 103 when I left. And I used to go and see her quite often. I used to take communion to her, and she used to be able to tell me that she'd actually been a member of that particular local church for 85 years and could prove it because she got all the membership tickets going back, and berated me because one year I didn't bother doing any. I had to go back and do some, I can assure you, so that she could complete a collection. But she always said to me, "I don't know why I'm still alive." And I used to say to her, "You're still alive because you bring us who come and see you some comfort and some joy. But I can't do anything for the church." And I said, "Well, you can, because you can say your prayers for us." And I knew very well that she did. Because prayer is an important part of support in any church's life. And if you think our ministers can just go on in their own self-sufficiency, just read what Paul did. The greatest evangelist of all time is asking this church that's got problems with heresy and all sorts of things to pray for him so that he might be able to preach the gospel. And prayer's got to be the fundamental foundation of everything that we do. I'll tell you a couple of brief stories of two churches. One church that was looking at its future and where it ought to go and what it ought to do. And I looked very carefully through some of the material it had, and I didn't see anywhere in it that said, "Will you pray that God might guide us?" I don't know where they expected to go. And another church that I was in actually about 4 weeks ago, an Anglican church in Sheffield, the church that my school friend, who actually died just over a year and a day ago, but I was up there with my wife and his widow, and we went to church as we usually do. And they had a cafe church that morning, and one of the things they were doing was concentrating on mission. And they had somebody to come and speak about different things, and one of the people who came and spoke was talking about a project of a church plant. You know what that is, don't you? You know that some of the congregation of one church takes over and goes somewhere else and starts a church. In fact, I understand that this church was begun that way by Victoria Baptist, which is now going into housing, as you well know. But then he said, "We've been praying about this and working at it for the last 2.5 years. So it wasn't something that they just snapped into. It wasn't something where they thought it was a good idea. They were actually seriously praying for God to guide them and show them the way. And they said, "We think that the opening has come and God has made it for this summer." I shall no doubt find out in the autumn when I go up what's happened. Prayer was the fundamental of all of it and must be. But I also get a little nervous when I go to some places and they have a little section on their newsletter which says, "Answered prayer." Now that makes me very nervous because it only seems to be the things that God has done that they asked for. So answered prayer for them was about something that God agreed with them about some things. What happened about all the other things they were saying prayers for? I believe that God answers every prayer, but he might not answer them in the way that we want or the way that we like. He might answer them in a way that we don't hear because we don't know where to listen. And we don't listen always in the right places, because God didn't always answer us when we were in a closed room saying our prayers, beginning "Our Father" and ending "Amen" in the silence. I found that God answers prayer by me bumping into people in the street, talking to people, conducting my ordinary life. God speaks to me about things that I've been trying to say to him. The next thing that I think Paul says here is it's about clear communications. Now, this is why I gave you a bit more of the background, that there were these Gnostics who were peddling things not dissimilar to what the Christians were doing in some ways. And that the churches, generally, actually, the early churches, but particularly Colossae, had begun to absorb some of it and take it to themselves. But one of the things I think that Paul is saying is that we have to have clear communications, and what we don't do is we don't dilute the gospel to fit into society. It's not an absorption into society that we need. It's something that actually speaks clearly about what we believe. And this is what Paul was trying to say about his preaching and about the church. Make sure that the communication is clear and that you are talking about the gospel. It's not trying to fit God in. It's not, and this is a wonderful lesson, I think, for the modern church today. It's not trying to say, how can we sort of keep most of our gospel and not offend most of the world, or some of the world, or some of society? It's about saying, this is what we believe, this is what we stand for. I am not trying to put the church back into the Dark Ages. I read about the time when everybody believed that the earth was flat, and then we learnt better, but some people still wanted to believe that the earth was flat. I don't want the church to be part of the Flat Earth Society, so that we want to go back to something and say science and all the other things are of no avail. It's very easy to actually try and say, how can we fit the church into some of the science we've got? Whereas in fact it should be, how does the science explain some of the things we believe? There was also a time when people believed the stars were actually held in place by God with his hands, because there are no other explanation. It's called the God of the gaps. We don't actually fill the gaps that we can't explain any other way by saying, well, God did it, because once we explain it another way, you're in real trouble, as they were about the stars. Once we stopped believing that God held them in his hands, what did that do for the Christian belief? So I don't want us to have the God of the gaps. I do want us to engage with modern society. I think that we've got to be careful how we change and adapt what we have got to fit into it, rather than saying it enlightens some of the things that we believe in. Clear communication. Actually be willing to speak about the gospel. There's something I'm sort of reluctant to deal with the next one, because it's a matter of wisdom. And I sometimes wonder whether I'm wise in anything, I can tell you. The older I get, the more I realise how little wisdom I've got. When I first went into college, our college principal, the first lecture he gave, which was a theology lecture, he had a blackboard. It was the only time he did. And he drew a circle on the blackboard, a little circle. And he said, that's the knowledge you've got now. If you look at the edge of the circle, that's how much you realise you don't know. When you've been in college for a little while, you'll have a bit more knowledge, so the circle will be a bit bigger. And that will encourage you to realise how much on the outside of that there is you don't know, and it's going to be a lot more than now. So the more you know, the more you realise how much you don't know. But I think in this context, the way that Paul uses wisdom is to say that we've got to be mindful of our actions and our reactions and the interactions to them. So that we've got to be careful, act wisely when we do speak to people, because our speech will affect them. What we say and what we do always affects people, not just because we're Christians, but that's just the way the world is. Whatever people do affects in their surroundings, and Paul is saying, be careful, be wise, watch and know what you're actually doing, and realize the effects that you can have and can't have, and make sure those effects are good effects. Like a good evangelist, and this is the fourth tool, that was the third, the fourth is that we've got to take every opportunity. One of my proud boasts is that I was on the board of Romford YMCA at one point, and that was a sort of a quasi-secular religious organisation, supposed to be an organisation of young people with Christianity at the centre, but sometimes it got moulded a little bit the way it went along. And I suggested one day that instead of playing the music that they did over the speakers in the place, that what they actually did was started playing some gospel music. And I was pleased the fellow who was in charge actually said, "That's Roger, always taking an opportunity. Always taking an opportunity." Is that true for us, that we always take an opportunity that is presented to us? How easily do we speak to people or not about our faith and about Jesus? It's also just not quite always in what we say, it's sometimes in what we do, because it's the way that we live too. So that this covers, and Paul actually talks about, sometimes you will be talking about God in things and sometimes you'll be talking not about God. I presume that what he means by that is sometimes you'll be in church talking about things and sometimes you'll be in the supermarket queue talking to the people who are around you. But make sure that whatever you do actually speaks about God. It's very easy when we're in disguise. You know, I don't wear this all the time. I gather that Sean is doing it now where he's presently living, and sort of his nickname, the Rev, that's what I've just been told in the vestry. And I say it with a smile because I remember saying, Sean wearing something that looked like a football jumper and shorts and a clerical collar. I don't think it was anything to do with the World Cup at the time, but we don't always wear our Christianity easily on our sleeve and invisible ways. And in fact, many of you can't do that unless you're wearing crosses or something or other. But we can by our behaviour. And Paul says it is an evangelical tool that we take every opportunity, and everything we do, whether it is formally speaking about God or indirectly speaking about him, something to do with quite different things in the world, even your shopping. It is the way that we behave, it's the things that we say that make the difference. The fifth tool, and this is the last one, and if I'd been given a choice in many ways, I would have preached a sermon on this alone. But partly because of the series and partly because God nudged me to say some of the other things. But that is, I'm going to read you one of those verses again. Because when I was reading through, this did, in many ways, just didn't make sense. I couldn't understand why it was there. I don't know whether there was anything in the reading, and we read it twice, that you noticed that seemed odd. Was there anything? Doesn't matter, I'll happily tell you. Let me just read this verse again. Let your conversation be always full of grace. Obvious. You expect Paul to say that. But then he goes on to say, seasoned with salt. Seasoned with salt. I'm going to do something I don't usually do, and that is, I brought some visual aids. This is the first one, which is some table salt. I suspect it's from Tesco's. Unknown brand. Doesn't matter much really, does it? Salt. Table salt. Cheapest chips. It wasn't at the time of Paul, and it wasn't in biblical times. Salt was extremely important and extremely valuable. It was so valuable that at one point you could actually use it as currency. You could pay with the stuff. My wife says she wouldn't buy it, but for me, and I don't care to think how old this is. I mean, actually, I only use this in my bread because I don't think it likes the salt that I use, which is that half salt. You know, it's not supposed to be good for my blood pressure, this stuff. And I take enough tablets for it, so I don't encourage it to get any worse. But she wouldn't put it in anything. And I'll guarantee that when she's cooking the vegetables at night, it's me who always says to her about the potatoes, have you put any salt in? And she sometimes now just says yes, without me asking the question. But the other thing was, I was so taken by the fact that it actually said salt, I wanted to find out whether it really, did or not. Now, this book looks a little battered, as though it's been worn a lot. It hadn't. It's battered because I bought it second hand and somebody else wore it out, not me, though I must say that I've had it for close on 50 years as well. But if you're not going to easily guess what it is, and I can hardly read it, but it's actually a Greek New Testament, and it's a Greek New Testament with certain things down one side, which is all the verbs, and tells you what tense they're in. I needed that when I was doing Greek, I can tell you, because it was all Greek to me. I really didn't understand it, and I struggled to actually be able to find even the right page and understand the headings of this. But I struck with that and found Colossians. I found chapter 4, and I found verse 6 with a struggle. And I looked up on Google what salt was in Greek, and I looked it up, and there it was. It did say, season with salt. Why did I want to look it up? Well, because a lot of the diction, the commentaries, and even the stuff on Google actually ignored it. At one point, one of the commentators, because I was trying to find out what they thought it meant, one of the commentators said that it was grace. So you read the sentence, which then says, always full of grace, seasoned with grace. That don't make sense. Paul did not use the word salt in there by accident. It was something that was very important. It was very important in society. It was very important in religion. Because salt in biblical times, one of the things it meant was covenant. The word salt and covenant, and I've only read this, and I'm not trying to pretend I'm knowledgeable. Salt and covenant are interchangeable. I thought, what? But they are. If you actually read the Old Testament, you can find in the scriptures that he says God is going to make a covenant of salt with them. A covenant of salt. Because salt did so many things. And I'm absolutely certain that Paul used it in many dimensions. He didn't just use it simply as one thing that salt might be, because it was used for many things. And he had many of those things, I'm sure, in mind. These were the things in biblical terms. One was that it meant covenant. And it meant covenant because salt endures. When you think about it, it contrasts then with the way that Jesus said, if salt has lost its saltiness, wherewith can it be salted? It's only good to throw out. And it would be very unusual for salt to have lost its saltiness, because it just doesn't. It's enduring. It's ongoing. It's almost everlasting. That's why they talked about the covenant between God and man that God made as being a covenant of salt. It's also a symbol of friendship and loyalty. In biblical days, friendship and loyalty are sealed with salt. Why salt? Well, because the essence of salt is simple. It doesn't change. And it's enduring for that. If you take some of this and you pour it in some boiling water and then you keep boiling the water, you'll finish up with the salt back in the bottom. It might be in a slightly different shape because it'll form crystals, but it'll still be there. It'll still be salty. It hasn't changed. And so they sealed friendship with salt. Of course, salt adds flavour. I've alluded to that already. You know, I can't eat eggs without a bit of salt in them. Some people hate it, some people love it. Again, in our family, I put some salt on and Lynn goes, because she just doesn't like salt at all. It also acts as a preservative and heals. This was one of the good things about it. I don't know whether you can imagine going back to life, some of you going back to life, some of you never having known it without a refrigerator or a freezer. I remember it when my grandmother used to have something that looked like a plant pot. It was not the plastic things that you get now, but a proper plant pot made of porous material. And it was shaped just a bit bigger than a milk bottle. She used to dip it in water and then she put it over the milk bottle because it used to keep it a little cooler. Evaporation causes cooling, they taught me at school. So they had nothing that kept anything except salt. And salt did. You can salt fish, you can salt beef, you can salt anything down so that when you've got the rich times and you can celebrate at harvest, you can be sure that all through the winter you've got something, however it might taste more of salt than anything else, but you've still got some of the protein left. It also heals. One of the things that they used to do in the days when we were more barbaric than we are now, when we used to use cat and nine tails and birches, was that we would, particularly at sea, when they used the cat and nine tails, they used to put some salt into the wounds. We've got an expression, rub salt into the wounds. We mean by it, you know, that when it's hurting, you make it hurt more. That's not what they meant by it. Perhaps it was initially, they also knew that rubbing salt in the wounds was the only chance you got of not going septic. I knew that from the days when you used to have those blue bags in crisps and used to tip them in, and it always used to bit my nails. I still do, but not as badly. And it used to find all the nicks everywhere when I'd actually managed to get anything through the skin, through biting my nails, the salt would penetrate. And the one thing that I learned out of this as well, that I didn't know, was that it's not only preserves and heals, it's actually a source of nourishment. You actually need salt. When I think about it, I know. Because my father worked down the pit and this stuff was scarce during the war. But he used to get salt tablets because he was going down the pit and sweating out and all the salt came out. You need salt to survive. So they gave him salt tablets. It's rich in trace minerals and it's nourishing to the body. Somebody should tell that to my doctor when he says, don't have any salt, shouldn't they? It was lots of things. It still is. I would just add a modern one that I'd learned on one of the baking programs, cooking programs, which is if you're going to grind up some garlic, you know how slippery they are and difficult it is to actually get hold of the things, put a bit of salt down and then use the flat blade of the knife to squash it, and the salt will hold it in place. The grit actually grips it. Paul said, let your conversation be full of grace so that we have an understanding in us all the time when we're speaking that we actually love the Lord Jesus Christ and speak to people like that. Sadly, I've been in all sorts of churches, I'm not going to major on this, where that is not true. it's worth thinking about. Whether even inside our community, we don't actually speak to each other with that sort of grace. But then Paul said, it isn't all grace, it's also sprinkled with salt. So that we put in something that is valuable, something that is lasting, something that is helpful, something that is healing, something that has nourishment that people can actually live on. It has all of those things. And use the grace, because at times we will say things too that, like the salt getting into my finger when I was eating those crisps, it was painful. And some of the things that we've got to say sometimes will be painful. But it's how you say them. You can actually rip somebody to bits because of something they're doing or saying, which doesn't do anything for them, doesn't do anything for you, doesn't do anything for Jesus. Or we can say things in such a way that they're filled with love and with grace. But also, we know that they will be painful things to say and maybe painful things in society. Make sure that we take all the opportunities. Make sure that we're clear in our communication. Make sure that we are trying to be wise in the way that we present things, and sprinkle everything with grace and the love of God for everybody, with salt at all its levels. And most of all, undergird it all with our prayers. Amen.